Medical Mutual wants to remind you it's almost time for Medicare's annual enrollment period. As a trusted health insurer for more than 90 years, Medical Mutual is here to help you find better Medicare benefits. Be confident you're getting the most from your Medicare Advantage plan. Schedule your free Medicare plan review today at medmutual.com/review. Medical Mutual, Ohio's hometown Medicare insurer.
What's up, Open Floor Globe? This is Ben Golver with the Washington Post. I am joined on the other line by Michael the Pod Pina of Sports Illustrated. Michael, I want to interrupt this regularly scheduled podcast with an important announcement. Nikola Jokic is your overlord. I saw over the weekend you were tweeting pro-Kawhi propaganda on your Twitter account, trying to take shots and jabs at me, Michael. I hope you saw what Big Jokic did on Sunday against the Utah Jazz. 47 points in an utterly dominant performance. Snapped their long winning streak. They hadn't lost in like a month, Michael. Then they ran into Jokic. Just absolutely everywhere in that game, shoving the ball down Rudy Gobert's throat. I don't think I've seen a better performance by any player in the league this season in terms of a single game. And I feel like consistently he is playing the best basketball of any player in the NBA. I feel the need to let everyone know and shout it from the mountaintop. And that's a Denver Nuggets very sly reference there, Michael. The mountaintop. Mm-hmm. First quarter MVP is Nikola Jokic. This guy is doing it big. He is just crushing all the advanced stats night after night after night. He's been carrying this team. It's finally turning into wins because they got some of their guys back on the court. And I just want everybody to bow down. I think it needs to be our obligation here on this show to become evangelists for Jokic. He could not care less about his post-game interviews. He's never going to hype himself up. He didn't want to chase 50 points in that game against Utah. None of it. And I think I just love it. He's about all the right things. He deserves a little bit of shine. And so let's give it to him right now. You're with me, Michael. He's the MVP in the NBA right now, right?
That was a terrific game. What do you have, 33 in the first half, 17 shots? Like, that's the mark of efficiency. I just really quick want to say that the price of real estate in your head right now that is owned by Kawhi Leonard is just – it's going up through the value is just through the roof. So I just want to point that out real quick.
No, come on, Michael. Even you could recognize this debate's looking great for me right now. Kawhi is actually playing phenomenal basketball as well. Right there in the mix with, just a fascinating MVP conversation that we're going to be tracking all year long. But let's give Jokic some due. Just a crazy, crazy stretch from him. I didn't know he was ever going to be this good. I mean, to me, he reminds me of the way he manipulates, offenses, like when he's bringing the ball up the court for them, setting them up, getting into it. It's very LeBron-like. He does it with a sophistication of a Chris Paul, but at the same time, it almost feels like he's cloned sometimes, Michael, because he'll set everything up, then he'll go down in the post, and like Friday night against San Antonio, down the stretch, he's drawing four defenders regularly. It's just like four guys are needed to stop him, right? And so it just looks very different because it's almost like he's setting the offense up, then he's finishing it, then he's basically, teeing his teammates up for shots. He's doing practically everything for them besides taking every single shot. And on Sunday, he was like, okay, here's what it's going to look like. If I do take every shot, we're going to win in blowout fashion. It's just amazing. Guys, if you're not watching Jokic, please fix that immediately. You will love life that much more. One of the great benefits, I would say, of all of us being stuck inside right now is we have zero good excuses to not watch the Denver Nuggets play basketball. All right, Michael, that was a complete tangent to start the show, but I do feel it in my heart. This is our calling right now. But we have a very, very fun show for you today, Michael. Dr. Bill, one of my buddies on Instagram who's been guiding us through the pandemic for the last year, had a real hard-hitting basketball question, and he wanted to know which NBA team is regretting their offseason the most, right? So is it the Boston Celtics with Gordon Hayward not quite getting as much production as Gordo with that trade exception up there in Boston? So are they regretting that decision? Could it be the Denver Nuggets for losing Jeremy Grant in free agency? Is it the hopeless Washington Wizards for getting a washed-up Russell Westbrook for a potential okay pairing of John Wall and Bradley Beal? So all sorts of things we could look back on from that rushed free agency period and start to second-guess, Michael. And so I want you to put on your 2020 hindsight glasses, okay? And I want you to settle in to your Monday morning quarterback jersey. And I basically want you to look back on those decisions that were made to kind of shape the season back there in November and December and say, at this point here, February 1st, which ones are looking the worst? Which are the ones you would really want to undo? And of course, I will chime in as well. And I think a key distinction to make here as we go along, do these decisions just look bad now, or do they look hopeless forever? In other words, okay, is it just a rocky start and we're going to give these guys a little bit of time to get things right? Or were these just catastrophic mistakes that are basically unsalvageable and have put some of these franchises behind the eight ball for years to come? All right, Michael, without further ado, I want to know some of your biggest regrets from the offseason. It could be players making bad decisions. It could be teams screwing things up. It could be you or me having a terrible take and now we have to undo it. It could be any of those things, Michael. What are some of your biggest regrets?
So going back to our last episode when we did we answered a question about a fictional LeBron James award, like how the NBA should honor him after he retires. And I came up with the idea of giving an award basically to the best free agent signing. And so for this year, I think there are three candidates. There are Gordon Hayward, Jeremy Grant, and Christian Wood.
Well, just to chime in real quick, our super listener Stavros in Australia replied to your idea saying that the LeBron James Award should just be the Agent of the Year Award, not the Free Agent of the Year Award. He put together our two ideas and said, well, look, if he's shuffling all these pieces around with the help of Clutch Sports, maybe the LeBron James Award should be the Agent of the Year Award. What do you think about that idea?
Not terrible. I personally like mine better, but not the worst.
Stavros is always thinking. But anyway, continue.
Yeah, so the three contenders here for this award are Gordon, Jeremy Grant, and Christian Wood. And I think Detroit letting Christian Wood go was just a magnificent blunder. Like, this guy is ripping the league to shreds right now. He's averaging 24 points, 11 rebounds. He's hitting threes. He's playing some defense now. I mean, the Houston
Michael,
Rockets have the... Whoa, what's up?
How is he on a defense that's so good? I didn't think he guarded anybody.
It's incredible. I mean, he's just huge. And he is surrounded by guys who play. I mean, the effort that like Tate and Tucker and some of these David Nwaba, like their effort is enough to overcome some lackadaisical moments from Christian Wood, I would say. But like the fact that Houston has the best defense in the NBA since they traded James Harden it's pretty funny. But the Pistons are probably, I don't know if they're the worst team in the league, but they're in that conversation. And to give up on this guy who you had in house, you developed him a little bit. Like, he came of age under your roof. He's 25 years old. You let him walk for on a 3-year, $41 million contract. Like, you couldn't pay that when you're paying Mason Plumlee big money, and you paid Jeremy Grant $19 million more over the same time period. Like, that is kind of a catastrophic decision by that organization.
Well, let me zoom back. I mean, is the regret Troy Weaver? Like, if you're ownership right now, and you're saying, hey, I took a shot on a first-time GM, right? Mm-hmm. And let's see how it goes. And Troy says, hey, I have an unconventional path to retooling this team. And you're like, I sure hope it doesn't involve one of the Plumleys. And he's like, dang it. No, it does involve one of the Plumleys. We're going to give him a lot of money. Well, I sure hope it doesn't involve overpaying a role player. Nope, guess what? Jeremy Grant, he's getting paid, and he's going to be our breakout star. You go right down the list of those decisions. We kind of questioned them at the time. In hindsight, would you just hit undo completely if you were Detroit and just kind of go a different direction? Now, I guess, you know, in Troy Weaver's defense, the Jeremy Grant signing is looking actually, you know, fairly good. And his vision for a player who could do a lot more than he was doing in Denver has proven true. Grant's numbers are through the roof, and he's a candidate for most improved player, I would say. But just about everything else hasn't worked at all. That would make me nervous if I was ownership, right? Because it's kind of like when you go down to Orlando and they were really excited about first-time GM Hennigan, right? Rob Hennigan. And you started to see his first like 9 to 12 months worth of moves. And I started to get itchy, and it took them like 4 years to figure it out. But, you know, at the end of it, it looks a lot better since he's been gone, since he was there. You just never know with the first-timers. It's a tough job to learn on the job. So would you undo the Troy Weaver experience if you could?
No, I mean, it's too early for that. He had a very questionable first off season, I think, and he wanted to shake things up. He certainly did shake things up. As you said, the Jeremy Grant signing, like, that was heavily criticized the second it happened. And Jeremy Grant looks really good. I mean, his numbers are terrific. I still don't know if I would pay him $60 million over 3 years or whatever he's getting, but he's certainly overperformed, I think, what expectations were. I like some of the draft picks they made. Isaiah Stewart, Sadiq Bey, those were good, smart moves. And then Killian Hayes just like got hurt after 7 or 8 games or something like that. And that's a tough blow. It's just too early for me to just, you know, say that they shouldn't have hired this guy, because, you know, as a GM, you are making decisions for the long term, and we got to see how some of these pan out.
If you would go back, could you take Halliburton over Killian Hayes? Would you do that?
You're stepping on some of my regrets here. Come on.
Oh, okay. Well, I'm just building on your overall case. Well, what about the other side on the Jeremy Grant thing from Denver? Because I'll be honest, this one has just kind of perplexed me. I think I've been on every single corner there is to be on the Grant. I mean, at first I was like, he's just absolutely not worth the money, right? And so if Detroit wants to pay him, you have to let him go. Then he played fairly well. To start the season, I was thinking, well, man, Denver could really use extra bodies, especially when Porter was out for the long-term absence due to the COVID protocols. I mean, Jokic is out there just carrying this team, a one-man army, and in a lot of those early season games, they're just losing because he didn't have enough help. And I was thinking, man, they really, really screwed up by not just paying whatever it takes to keep Jeremy Grant. Now I'm almost in the camp where Jokic is this legit MVP candidate. And I'm just wondering, can you afford as a franchise to let talent out the door? Did they just have to pay him no matter what, Jeremy Grant, you know, pay him? And then if they have to trade him down the road or find some way to turn him into a different asset, whatever it might have been, was there some price that they could have actually been able to keep him rather than just letting him leave? Because they have let a number of pieces over these last 2 years, leave with basically, you know, no compensation coming back, or just, you know, very young players kind of stepping in to fill roles or whatever else. And I just think that they need to be in title thinking mode right now, given how well Jokic is playing. I mean, I think to me, he's like a top three guy in the league right now. And if we were looking at, you know, say a Brooklyn Nets around Kevin Durant, or a Lakers around LeBron James, if they were kind of, you know, treating assets the same way Denver has in terms of, you know, playing money ball a little bit, trying to squeeze value, you know, being okay if guys get too expensive and just letting those guys go, I think there would be a bigger outcry on behalf of the star player saying, wait a minute, you got to make sure you're keeping this guy, you know, with as much talent around him as possible. So what do you think from Denver's side? Regret, or are you kind of okay with the Jeremy Grant experience?
No, I think I'm okay with what Denver did. I mean, there's two things. One, you're making the comparison with LeBron and KD in terms of, you know, needing to push all your chips in a little bit, if I'm kind of getting what you said.
Correct. I don't want you to be guilty of the soft bigotry of low expectations here, Michael. Just thinking, you know, Denver's never going to win a title, so they don't really have to worry about it. They just let Jeremy Grant go. It'll be fine. I mean, they've got a piece here right now that could really do some big things. And you look back on some of these other guys that they have left in the last couple of years, and you're thinking, man, just plug that into Denver's lineup, they'd be killer right now.
Yeah, I mean, I think that, you know, Jokic is obviously only 25 years old. Those guys are, you know, the clock is ticking on some of those other names. But, like, I think one of the players that we forget about when we look back on the bubble experience for Denver is Will Barton. And
true,
Will Barton has been really good this season. Their starting lineup has been gangbusters, particularly on offense. Just I like 1.24 points per possession is nothing to play around with. So they've been kind of humming there. And I believe that the Denver Nuggets were willing to pay or match that salary that Jeremy Grant eventually took from the Detroit Pistons. Or offer the same amount, but he wanted a bigger role. He would have never had the ball in his hands in the ways that he does now if he stayed in Denver. So that was kind of like a personal decision on his part, which you have to respect.
I just think it's tough to watch that talent walk out the door. And in most cases, you know, as with like Gordon Hayward and the Celtics, I'm sure we're going to get to them later. You know, whenever that happens, you know, it just changes things. Like I look at Boston right now and I think, man, the Eastern Conference would be theirs if they still had Hayward, right? The door is wide open for the Boston Celtics right now. And they've just kind of been, you know, jogging or stumbling through the season so far. And I kind of feel the same way about Denver. They would have a real opportunity to make some noise here this season again, had they found a way to just manage that asset better. And maybe it's not just the decision right before the season starts. Maybe at that point it's too late. Maybe it's you got to, you know, zoom back in time a little bit and prepare and cover your bases. You know, I'm not sure, but I do think it warrants some level of second guessing.
Real quick, just like a question for you about Gordon Hayward, since you brought him up. Like, I don't know how that is. Like, what would you do if you were the Celtics to change that situation? Would you have, participated in a sign and trade with the Indiana Pacers to get reportedly like someone like Doug McDermott and Miles Turner? Would you have
anything besides what they did? I mean, come on.
Well, no, but like he's a free agent, right? So he had offers from 5-6 teams, he said, that he could have gone to. And
well, first of
obviously
all,
he didn't want, well, one second. Obviously he didn't want to take the third or fourth role offensively behind Kemba, Tatum, and Jaylen Brown. And for those last two guys have just ascended to heights that Gordon Hayward cannot reach right now. So like, to his credit, he wanted the ball more. He wanted more touches. He wanted more shots. He's getting that. And a little bit more money, I'm sure.
Yeah, I know. But he just wanted the money, and Boston didn't want to pay him. I mean, I think that ultimately that one came down to, look, he knew he would be worth more to a team that didn't have a star than he would be worth to the Celtics, who already had some big salaries on the books. And Boston decided, hey, we're not going to load up and just spend no matter what. We've got to at least have some eye towards the bottom line here. And I think that when his contract number first came out, everybody was like, holy cow, this guy's not worth that. He's been super injury ravaged and everything else. And this is one of those situations where the 2020 hindsight says, hey, he's actually worth that money, at least for right now. That contract could still come back to bite you a couple months down the road. But there's no way Boston isn't a better team right now if they had kept Hayward. And they would be, you know, I think probably the best team in the Eastern Conference had they done so. Well, don't you want to strive for greatness, Michael, or do you want you're comfortable
sure.
just in the bronze medal territory like usual?
No, I do like winning, and Boston has won more than any other team in the league throughout their history. But I will say that, you know, Hayward that we're seeing right now in Charlotte is not the Hayward that we would have seen had he re-signed in Boston. Like, that's just, and even if he did come back and was healthy and looked really good, we would not see this Jaylen Brown. Like, you can't have all of these things in on a basketball team kind of all rising at the same time. That's really not how it works. So, like, I you know, it would be nice if Gordon stayed. And it's not even really about the money with Gordon so much as what he would have done to Jaylen Brown's development and Jason Tatum's development. And those two guys look like they should start in the All-Star game, frankly. They look terrific. So I don't really know.
Not both of them, Michael. Come on. Don't
okay,
be too silly.
Okay. They're both okay. But so
Jaylen can start in the All-Star game. Your point is well taken. Look, you're not going to get the 25-5-4 version of Gordo if he stays. And you're definitely not getting the 27-point version of Jaylen Brown if he has to spread the ball around. My point is, you're not going to win a title if you don't have Gordo, and you would have had a much better shot if you had just kept him, because now you've got all the talent. Now you can roll out really interesting lineups to match up better with the Brooklyn Nets and LA Lakers and LA Clippers of the world. And, you know, the point of the Boston Celtics is not to bring out the absolute best stats for Jaylen Brown. The point is to have the best lineups that you can use and to maintain that balance. And for a while there, it worked pretty well for you guys, and you looked pretty deadly. Now you've got lineup holes in the front court, and you know, I just think you're going to be in situations where you're really going to wish you had him down the stretch, especially if he continues to play this way. To me, this is only a short-term second-guessing, though, because there's always the possibility that his contract winds up looking pretty rough in the not-too-distant future. He's had the injury issues, so I actually don't crush Danny that much for not wanting to pay him that money. I get it, especially having those other younger guys already in the pipeline, knowing you're going to have to pay them massive, massive contracts, and also knowing that they're your future. But for this short-term window, like this year and next year, I mean, I think it was open for them. And to me, it's more closed than it was based on that decision. I think that's cause for a little bit of regret, especially because you couldn't get anything else back. We've all got to bank on that amazing trade exception, Michael. If he comes through with something on the trade exception, then we can undo the 2020 hindsight and Boston will be all right. if not, you know, it just kind of looks like, you know, it looks like they cut a corner there. All right, well, who else you got for your biggest regrets?
Okay, so real quick, I just want to, you know, run over a regret that I have personally from a take I had coming into this season, and to be honest, through the first couple weeks of the season, maybe. But you know, I was stubborn in my steadfast belief in Harden sticking with the Houston Rockets.
Oh boy!
And you know, especially after they traded for Christian Wood, and they bring in John Wall, who I thought could be really good. Still, I was totally wrong about that. I believed basically that they could be a force in the playoffs up until James Harden's press conference where he crapped on all of his teammates. So I was late for that one.
Well, let me ask you, Michael, was your decision-making influenced by the fact that I was saying the opposite? Because that happens sometimes, you know? You just realize, like, you know, you get into these situations, not you specifically, but podcast co-hosts, where the other person says something, you've just got to go the other way no matter what, because you just fundamentally disagree with them as a person. Was this a situation where you're like, I can't wrap my mind around it because Ben said it, so I'm just going the other way no matter what?
Yeah, it's just like what I basically just said, where Aaron Nesmith is a better fit for the Celtics than Gordon Hayward. Oh. That's, like, that's basically what, the exact same thing.
Well, let me ask you, how are you feeling about these post-Harden Rockets? Because they are at 500 right now. They have an incredible defense like you've described. They have had a number of guys break out in unexpected ways. You know, Wood's been even better than advertised. Tate has been kind of a very pleasant surprise, kind of out of nowhere for Houston. I think Steven Silas seems like he's just loving life after the trade. Oladipo has been kind of the best case version of what they maybe expected after that trade. I mean, I had pretty low expectations for him down there. And so he certainly surpassed that. And then they won the big John Wall versus the Wizards death match last week in convincing fashion as well. So there's some positive things going on for Houston. How are you feeling about the Rockets now that they did pull the trigger? You know, the one that you didn't want them to for months and months.
I feel okay about where they are in the short term. I think I'm a little more. I mean, their long term is just a total unknown, so it's hard to say whether I'm bullish or not. But I do like Christian Wood. I do like Oladipo. I think John Wall has played pretty well. It's, you know, I am really intrigued by just their brand of basketball and, you know, how physical they are with PJ, Nwaba, Tate. Like, those guys are just like horses out there, and that's really fun to watch. But I think, like, when you're, you know, on a just like a pure talent level, I would not be surprised if they kind of stumbled and fell off a little bit. Their defense has been really good, but they've had a lot of three-point luck where opponents just aren't making any shots against them. And I think that that's just that has nothing to do with how they're playing defense or their schemes or anything like that. So I could see them coming back to earth on both ends pretty soon, which is kind of a bummer. But long term, like, who knows what this team can do with those draft picks and the aggression that the front office has shown. It's going to be fun to see what happens.
Yeah, I think they're going to, you know, run out of gas here at some point with the chip on the shoulder stuff. I mean, that can last for a while, but, like, ultimately talent's going to win out. I think they're coming back to earth, but that's not the end of the world. I do think it's going to be an awfully long time before they're, like, a relevant factor in, like, a playoff chase. I mean, it could be years and years and years and years. From that standpoint, would you have just tried to make it work with Harden? You know, do you regret the Harden trade in any way, Michael, now that it's happened? Was it the right decision? Like, I was trying to sell you for a couple months, because trying to talk ourselves into Jay Sean Tate and maybe it's going to be re-signing Oladipo, I mean, that's a different life. You know, that's reality did set in. You're counting down until the 2027 draft. Could you have just taken a harder line and been tougher with James Harden? What do you think?
I don't know. I guess, like, the other question is, you know, do you take Philly's package, whatever Philly was offering, which that's Ben Simmons plus some other stuff, and how you'd feel about that. It's just, it's really difficult to kind of look so far down the line, knowing you own, I mean, we've talked so much about the Nets since they made that trade, and last night the Nets, I mean,
yes,
that game was like the epitome of what I thought the Brooklyn Nets would look like with those three. So maybe having, like, owning their entire future is going to be a very good thing for Houston. We don't know.
I'm glad you brought that up. That brings me to my next regret: Brooklyn hiring Steve Nash.
Wow.
Look, here's the thing. I'm not saying it's a regret forever. You know, he's a rookie coach. There's going to be some growing pains on the job. I promise you that if Steve Nash sticks as a winning head coach and he becomes, like, you know, the next Steve Kerr or whatever else you want to say, he personally will look back at how he has managed, or really not managed, these first 20 games, and he will just be so regretful about all of it. He will not even be able to watch without cringing, Michael. It's unbelievable, these late game situations where they kick away games and he just does nothing. No timeouts, no good play calls. The ATOs make no sense. They don't get good shots. They've got all this talent just being squandered in these late game situations. It's unbelievable. It's been going on since early December. And as you mentioned, we saw just an incredible choke job last night.
That was real bad. Oh my God.
They gave up an 8-0 run, I believe, in the last 12 seconds to the Washington Wizards. Bradley Beal hits a three. They throw the ball away to absolutely nobody. Had a timeout, didn't use the timeout, of course. Joe Harris just basically hands the ball straight to Russell Westbrook, who somehow hits a three-pointer for the first time all season to bury them. You come down on the ATO. The Washington Wizards double-teamed Kevin Durant off the ball on the inbounds pass while also guarding the inbounds pass. I don't think I've ever seen that in my entire life. Didn't seem like Steve Nash was prepared for it. They couldn't get the ball to KD, which is where they obviously wanted to go. Everyone knows they want to go there. Just completely outfoxed by Scott Brooks in that situation. It's just tough, man. And I really do think, you know, Steve Nash, once he does get his legs at some point in the future, is going to look back and be like, man, I have cost our team like four of our losses already. And we're 6 weeks into the season. And look, it's not saying regret forever. It's just regret for right now. He's going to have to do better in the playoffs, man. They are going to lose a series right now because of their coaching. That's not hyperbole. It's not over the top. I don't take any joy in saying that. It's been that bad in late game situations. And part of it is just the philosophy. It's this idea of, hey, I'm just going to let these guys play. It's worse than D'Antoni. D'Antoni at least knew to take timeouts, Michael, and he could draw things up and he could kind of just like refocus people. It's just this complete, like, just let the guys do whatever they want. There's a difference between being the cool substitute teacher who just kind of lets the kids, you know, use their free time and, you know, not too much structured learning, right? You know, maybe it's, you can just draw for this hour. We could put on a videotape and watch it and have a good time. That's acceptable. Just walking out of the room and letting the kids light the place on fire is not an acceptable behavior. And right now, Nash is kind of trending towards that second territory. Just bring it back to the cool substitute teacher category, who at least takes attendance and makes sure people have showed up for class and all that stuff.
Right now, Nash is the substitute teacher who walks in the room and just passes out cigarettes. Is that what you're saying, basically?
Yes. Yes. Or he's just out, you know? It's just, he shows up and it's like, oh, I got a meeting somewhere. He just disappears for 45 minutes. So where are you going? Use your timeouts.
Okay. Okay, so I have a couple really quick points. One, I want to be fair to the Nets on that last play. TLC had a wide open layup that he just bricked. Like, I don't, like, that stinks for him.
Was there any moment of that play where you thought he was going to make that layup?
No, but it was a wide open layup.
It was, but it was not designed by Steve Nash. I could promise you that. TLC just realized that Washington had been completely disrespectful with its defensive coverage and left him completely untouched, so he waltzed right to the basket, still couldn't finish it. Not a great surprise there. I was glad Kyrie Irving saw it. I was a little bit nervous he wouldn't, or they wouldn't be able to figure anything else out. Mm-hmm. So from some sense, like, credit to the players for improvising on the fly in a high-pressure moment, but I could promise you that's not what Steve Nash wanted to happen, drew up. And it goes back to the same problem they had inbounding the ball, you know, a week or two ago, where everyone knows you want to go to Kevin Durant. So you've got to be more creative. Let him run off a screen. You can't just have him kind of standing there trying to post somebody up. He doesn't have that great lower body strength to always be able to hold his position. He can get pushed off of it. And then if a team does double team him, now you're completely stuck. And like, you can't even get him the basketball. It's just, it feels rudimentary to me. I just don't feel like this was ever a problem in Golden State where like they just like could not inbound the basketball in high pressure situations. It just feels like some of these things we would just take for granted. Maybe it's a lack of practice time, possibly. I'm not sure, but it's just mind-blowing. You can't blow a seven-point lead to the Washington Wizards, a team that has barely even played this season and has some of the most damaging individual players in the league. It's just a roster full of regrets, Michael. We're talking regrets right now. This whole roster is regrettable, and no, you drop that game. Come on.
I think the biggest difference real quick between the Golden State Warriors with Kerr and these Nets is that those Golden State Warriors had a year under Mark Jackson or a couple years under Mark Jackson where they went to the playoffs together. They felt pain together. They grew together. Like, this is just like we're throwing Kyrie, KD, and Harden now just against a wall and kind of seeing what happens. And you watch, like, defensively, they have no core belief system. It's like when Jeff Green is at the five, or even when Perry is at the five, they just switch everything, and it doesn't matter what the mismatches are, or like who that puts Kyrie Irving on, or what's going on. And sometimes even when DJ's at the five, like Kyrie will want to switch a pick and roll with DeAndre Jordan, and it's like, what? Why would you do that? It makes absolutely no sense, and it makes you wonder. Like, what is Steve Nash even preaching that this would be a possibility or something that Kyrie can just feel he can freelance and do? It does also remind me of when we did an episode, I think before the season began, about like coaches on the hot seat potentially. And I brought up Steve Nash as a possibility because I thought that there would be a lot of expectations, obviously championship expectations. You got to win now. And he had just relative question marks compared to some of the other names out there. And I don't know, man. Like, I'm not saying that he's going to get fired or anything. That feels like very hot takey and very talk radio to talk about that right now. But he's not necessarily, I would say, part of helping them get towards where they want to go at this juncture. Is that fair? I'm talking to you. I know you think that's fair. But
yeah, well, a couple thoughts. First of all, you'll notice I'm not even mentioning the defense because it's so disastrous, and that was not even supposed to be his purview. So I'm just giving him a complete pass for one of the worst modern defenses like we've ever seen. I'm just giving him a pass. I'm just nitpicking the things that I think he should be good at because of who he was as a player and who we thought he was as a thinker, right? Steve Nash should be able to drop a killer inbounds play just off the drop. Like, that should be no problem whatsoever. He should understand intuitively, here's the guys we need to get the basketball to in these situations. Here's how we're going to do it, because he spent his life doing that for years and years and years at an extraordinarily high level and thinking the game at a level most people could never think the game at, right? So that's what's confusing to me. I don't understand why it's not translating and he's not having some level of impact in these situations. Despite all of this, the biggest fairness to Steve Nash is this. Despite those blown games, despite the lack of attentiveness in some of these late game situations, Brooklyn's still the 2 seed in the Eastern Conference at 13-9. Their true record should be, you know, I would say, you know, probably something like 18-4, you know, something like that. And okay, what's really the difference there? I mean, you can kind of chalk that up to like, hey, we're figuring it out, we're going to go forward, and eventually we're going to play better in those situations, so we're going to be fine. So I'm not sure we're ready to have the hot seat talk with Steve Nash. I just think like he is going to regret some of the stuff that's happened to this point, and if it continues, then we're not too far away from some of those other darker conversations. I'm not sure I have a real candidate I think would have necessarily been better at managing these personalities, so I wouldn't undo the hiring of Steve Nash. I still think it was smart to try to get someone who would be the most equipped to communicate with a Kyrie Irving and a Kevin Durant and potentially a James Harden once those guys are in the building. And it does seem like he's established some level of rapport there, but we're going to need a little bit more structure now. I think that we've reached that stage of the season for them.
A quick question, though. Do you think the Nets, like how much better do you think the Nets would be if they had Ty Lue as their coach than Steve Nash?
Like I said, 18-4. five games. I think he's cost him at least five games this season, straight up. Like, in the late game situations, they've been a disaster, and it makes no sense. And if they were even just sort of like league average in those situations, I wouldn't harp on it. But these guys have incredible talents who should be pulling these games out, and they're getting sniped down by Garrison Matthews and Russell Westbrook last night. Come on. All right, Michael, rant over. Let me hear some more of your regrets. What do you think?
Okay, this is one that you kind of stepped on a little bit for 2 seconds earlier, but Tyrese Haliburton, the Pistons, the Knicks, the Wizards, and the Suns, I think are just, they got to be kicking themselves for not taking this guy. Like, he is a tremendous basketball player. He's going to be a tremendous basketball player for years.
Is he really the rookie of the year so far, Michael?
I mean, he's top two, top three. I think LaMelo is going to have a case, probably. LaMelo's been really good, particularly in the last 10 or so games. But yeah, I mean, if I had a vote, I'd probably say Haliburton, especially when you consider like where he is and what his environment is like. Like, could you imagine him playing on the Suns, like with Chris Paul, and just like in a more structured environment? I think, like, man, he'd be even better.
Sometimes the draft night second guessers just nail it. And I think that's absolutely one that we raised. You know, what was Phoenix doing? He's looked just as advertised. I think he's the first quarter rookie of the year right now. I do think he's going to have some trouble hanging on to that title. I think we've got a long way to go in the rookie of the year race, because you're seeing a number of guys kind of pop up. You know, Quigley from New York is trying to get into the mix. You've got LaMelo Ball. Absolutely. I had him number two through the first quarter. Anthony Edwards is going to continue to put up numbers, especially if their season, you know, keeps going south and he gets more playing time. And then I think Weissman's a factor too. So yeah, it's going to be hard for him to necessarily hold that award if he remains kind of in this bench role for a team that's not great. But I think through the first quarter, he's been that guy. Super good decision-making, stable, steady, you know, a lot of confidence too for a guy who's 20. I mean, just kind of plugs right in and is ready to rock. You know, it's a situation where if they didn't have him in Sacramento, I wonder what their record would look like. And then I just wonder how much darker things would be, right? Like, if he hadn't fallen into their laps, things would be really darn messy right now.
They would. I mean, you wonder, like when is De'Aaron Fox going to start asking for a trade? Like, I don't. He literally just signed his max extension. It's tough there. It's tough there. And I think changes are going to be coming pretty soon for... I guess the coach would be the first one to go. Their defense is just so atrocious. But I think, like, getting back to it, some of the teams, you know, it's obviously really early. Killian Hayes, as I said earlier, hasn't really played, has that hip injury. Obi Toppin looks okay, whatever. He might be fine. They got Quickly, so they're not, like, starving for a young guard who can really, like, pop. But Haliburton there with that first pick of theirs would have been really fun. And like, even Denny Avdia has been like pretty good and I think will be a perfectly fine choice. But Haliburton going where he went was just such a, like, again, we knew it on like that night, and all of the really smart people who follow this stuff, who've been analyzing these prospects for years, thought that Haliburton could go as high as two or should go as high as two. So for him to drop as far as he did, it's a catastrophe.
No, I hear you. I'm going to start reading a couple questions from various Open Floor Globe members. They emailed us, openfloormail@gmail.com, openfloormail@gmail.com, and we'll see what exactly do we regret about these situations. Tom in Texas writes, between watching the Mavs record be less than stellar and the Friday night slaughter at the hands of the Utah Jazz, it's certainly looking like there is something deeply wrong in Dallas. It's amazing that Luka, who looked great in the bubble, has just been so flat this year. Even with Kristaps Porzingis back, their record has been well below 500. Dr. Golliver, what is your diagnosis? And the Mavericks right now, as we're talking, are 8-12. And we've gotten a number of emails about people saying, well, is it time to raise the red alarm about the Dallas Mavericks? Did Michael finally get one right with his preseason takes? getting a lot of those, Michael, a lot of those. Well, so I ask you, is there anything that Dallas did here since the bubble that they should regret? Anything that you would undo if you were the Mavericks? Or is there some other point that you would like to highlight in terms of why they have fallen so short of expectations? Look, it's a very fluid situation right now, but Dallas is 13th in the West. Certainly, I don't even think their biggest hater, Michael Pina, thought they were going to be that bad to start the season. And I'm sure they're going to finish better in the standings when it all shakes out. But what would you diagnose, Michael?
I mean, I'm happy that I was right, for sure. And a lot of
it's over. It's over. They're hopeless.
Call the season. No, I don't think they're hopeless. I think that a lot of the reasons why I thought they would be behind in the standings early on have come to fruition. You know, I thought they were thin. I thought that Kristaps missing 10 or so games and then not being able to play in back-to-backs. You know, we saw he didn't play in a back-to-back in their loss against Phoenix, where they lost by, 6 points, a couple possessions. I'm sure he would have been a factor there. I couldn't foresee how COVID would impact their team, and that has been really bad. You know, Maxi Kleber, who's playing really good basketball at the start, he's been out for a while. But the one transaction that I can really look at is Josh Richardson for Seth Curry. And that was a move that I think was applauded by a lot of people for Dallas. And the thinking was that Josh Richardson would help their defense and provide a little bit of diversification into the offense. He can make some plays, he can shoot the three ball, etc. I was down on it because I think Seth Curry is, he's one of the best shooters who's ever lived. And, you know, his impact in the bubble in particular was pretty high level. And when Luka sits, having someone like that who can really stretch the defense, who can really, you know, he can run pick and roll too. I think he's just a really good, smart player. And I understand why they made the move. He's 3 years older than Richardson. And again, defense was an issue last year for them. But look, Josh Richardson, when he's on the floor this season, Dallas's defensive rating is 109.5. When Josh Richardson is off the floor, Dallas's defensive rating is 109.5. Offensively, they are the Detroit Pistons when Josh Richardson is on the floor. He is shooting 28% from behind the three-point line. He is posting a career low in assist rate, lower than even when he was a rookie. So the fit offensively doesn't really seem to be working. And he's missed some time because of the health and safety protocols. And he basically has not been able to play at all with Kristaps and Luka, which is why I'm not like giving up on the Dallas Mavericks at all. But I think that they need this guy to be. I know they have Tim Hardaway Jr., who's a fine player as well, but in my opinion, they need Josh Richardson to be their third best player if they want to be the best version of themselves that they can possibly be. And he's very, very far from that, and I don't know if he'll get to that level that they need him to get to this season. So like, I look at that move, and I'm kind of like, if they had Seth Curry, who is absolutely tearing things up in Philly and a reason why Philly's starting lineup is one of the best lineups in basketball, that's what I would look to.
Yeah, I think I'm with a lot of that. I don't know if I would necessarily regret that Josh Richardson move yet. I do think that it's regrettable through this first quarter, but I think, you know, their biggest issue right now is that their whole approach was built on elite offense. They haven't been able to get to that elite offense. Well, so what are the two reasons they haven't gotten there? Well, there's two of them, and you named them both. One, they haven't had the continuity because guys have been in and out of the lineup, and they just, you know, it's been a different lineup every day, whether it's injuries or health protocols. It's a very similar situation to Miami. I actually think Miami's had it worse than anybody, with the possible exception of Washington, who couldn't even field teams for there for 2 weeks, right? So I am actually giving both Miami and Dallas like a wide berth this season as they try to pull themselves together, because what made their life so fun, what made them so entertaining to watch, what made Luka look so spectacular was having a lot of weapons around him all functioning together, and Dallas just really hasn't had, you know, that level of talent. The second point to me, though, it's the issue of Porzingis. Like, I thought they were just going to be able to hang on till he gets back. Look, yeah, maybe he'll rest on back-to-backs like you're saying, but when he plays, he should have a monster impact, right? And that has just not been the case.
Nope. Now,
I don't want to pick on him too much because he's only played 9 games, Michael. but he's shooting 28.6% on three-pointers, and he's taking more than 6 3-pointers per game. To find players who have basically done that over the course of a season, it's incredibly rare. Here's the list. 37-year-old Kobe Bryant, Blake Griffin last year, 2008 Gilbert Arenas, right, where things were kind of coming apart there in Washington, and then 2000 Jason Williams, White Chocolate, and then Porzingis. Like, those are the only guys in NBA history who have been that damaging on three-pointers and relying that heavily on that being a part of their game. And a big problem is Porzingis has got to hit those shots because he's got to stretch the defense so Luka can attack. So if he's not hitting, defenses don't have to respect him, then everything is going to get bottled up and things look a lot differently. Kind of contributing to that factor, you know, in terms of his lack of offensive effectiveness, when he does go to the post or he does basically anything else right now, it's not working. So I don't think his body's right. He's not getting to the free throw line nearly as much. He's just shooting poorly, you know, basically anywhere you put him. He has not been the guy he was before the injury in last year's playoffs or at times during the bubble, and he just hasn't been anything close to his best self, and that's a huge problem. I mean, like a lot of teams where, you know, you're relying on stars, if that number two guy goes out, you look different. You know, look at the Portland Trailblazers, right? You lose CJ McCollum, that team looks different. We bring their ceiling down, and kind of a similar effect in Dallas. So if I was going to scapegoat anything, I would say it's Porzingis. I don't think you regret trading for him or any of that stuff. I don't think you regret even giving him the contract at the point you gave it to him. You had to, but you do regret the slow, you know, recovery or rehabilitation or whatever else. He's got to be better or they're toast. That's kind of how I look at him.
No, I mean, I don't know if you watched that game, the blowout against the Utah Jazz over the weekend, but like the Jazz put Rudy Gobert on Dorius Finney-Smith and just like let him shoot threes, and he was not hitting his threes, and they put Royce O'Neal on Kristaps Porzingis and had absolutely no problems. So I jot down notes in my little notebook as I watch basketball games, and a lot of them are really dumb, and I regret writing them, and I'm glad no one can read what I write. But I'll just read something real quick out loud, like, does Kristaps Porzingis have the worst contract in the NBA?
Oh, boy.
Something that I put in my notebook. I don't think that, but it was going through my head when I was watching that game, because I was like, if this guy, I assume he will be better, and like physically better than what we've seen so far, but if this guy is going to look this way, like, from, I mean, it's not like he's just like this testament to good physical conditioning and health, right?
So no, he misses games every year. Absolutely. It's an ongoing concern.
Yeah. So the way I see it is, if this is what he's going to look like, Dallas has some serious long-term problems. Like, I don't know what this offseason is huge, because this is their last opportunity to really improve their product through free agency before you got to pay Luka. I don't know. It's like, I don't think Kristaps is worth that money. I really don't.
I hear you. I'm glad you brought up the idea of, you know, switching a smaller guy onto Porzingis and Utah being able to get away with doing that. We saw the exact opposite when they tried that strategy with Jokic, didn't we? Where they go a little bit smaller to just kind of give him an early look, try to get underneath him and bother him. And Jokic just waltzes those guys down into the post, does drop steps, you know, flinging layups, swish, swish, swish. I mean, that's why he had 20-plus in the first quarter, is because that going small strategy just absolutely did not work at all. He knew exactly how to exploit it. And that just tells you there's a gigantic gap between Porzingis and Jokic. No huge surprise, but that strategic element right there kind of boils it down almost better than anything else. Michael, you have any other regrets?
I do. I've got a couple for you. One of them, okay, I got two. Kelly Oubre to the Warriors. I'm just going to spit it
Thank you. Thank you for mentioning that. It kind of reminds me of this whole short-selling situation with GameStop, doesn't it? Like, you got these billionaires making these gigantic risks, and if they backfire, it costs them just unbelievable amounts of money. Isn't that exactly what happened to Joe Lacob? Like, isn't Kelly Oubre GameStop?
I think you might have just explained this whole phenomenon to me better than the New York Times has been able to. So thank you. I had no idea what was going on this whole time, but that's exactly what it is. Like he is, like this is a total, like I don't want to be too harsh here, but look, like the putback dunks, they're fun. Those like pesky offensive fouls that he draws, and then he gets up and he shouts, and the bench gets excited. Those are cool. But the Warriors are a 25-win team when he plays, and they play like a 53-win team when he doesn't.
Oh, my God.
In the first 10 games of the season, he infamously shot 13.7% from behind the three-point line. And, you know, you would think, like, based on how the coverage is of Kelly Oubre, that he's kind of righted the ship a little bit and that he's making his shots. But in the next 10 games, he's only at 32%. So, and that's not overall, that is in those 10 games, he's at shooting 32% behind the three-point line. So it's just been a really rough ride for him. I mean, the amount of money that they paid, sure, whatever, that's not my money, I don't care. But he's definitely not, like, you think about Klay Thompson, like, it is a universe apart.
I do think that one benefit of the Kelly Oubre experience is that we're never going to have to hear that argument from a team's fan base again. Well, hey, it's not my money. It's just ownership's money. What do I care if they pay a guy $80-something million? If you have to watch this every single night, you know this guy is not worth that situation, and he was just the wrong guy to bet on. I was pretty vocal about that at the time. I just would not have done that if I were them. I think you're seeing that every single night play out in these Twitter conversations about this guy, Kelly Oubre. It's not his fault that he's racking up this luxury tax bill. That's obviously ownership's fault. But, man, I wish they had just exercised a little bit more restraint there, because they would have been in a better spot, I think, overall. Michael, what about are we dancing around the biggest one here with Russell Westbrook? I mean, if we're saying, has anything backfired worse than Russell Westbrook to the Washington Wizards? And I know he did put up 40-plus, and he, you know, exposed Steve Nash yet again, like we were talking about earlier. But that was basically his one good game of the entire season. He's missed a bunch of time health-wise. You know, in a way, he's had basically as devastating an impact on his team's offense as a Kristaps Porzingis, because he just hasn't been able to shoot the ball, hasn't been able to get to his better spots. They did have to toss away a first-round pick in that John Wall trade. And you've got Bradley Beal looking upset night after night after night in some of these situations where his body language issues are, you know, transforming not only from kind of the end of blowout losses to now like the first half of games where he's, you know, almost quitting in the middle of plays. And to me, that's really unacceptable from him. He needs to be better on those situations. At the same time, I can empathize. Like, I would really have a hard time staying locked and engaged night after night if my winning formula relied so heavily on Russell Westbrook and a whole bunch of guys that, you know, are kind of fringe NBA talents on that roster. So was that some 2020 hindsight? That was one where I actually thought Washington, you know, potentially was, you know, pulling the plug on the John Wall experience at the right moment. And it still could wind up, you know, going in their favor at some point if Wall winds up having health issues or something like that. I mean, I don't think the story of this trade is necessarily written completely. But through the first quarter of the season, that's been the biggest, you know, biggest backlash of any of them, right?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think that the Russell Westbrook we saw against the Brooklyn Nets last night is the Russell Westbrook that we will get on a consistent basis for the rest of his career, which is really sad to say. And, you know, like, I'm sure you agree with me, but watching him just be the physical force that he is, like downhill in transition, like last night against the Brooklyn, like that's so much fun. I love watching him do stuff like that. And
yeah, speak for yourself on that one. I mean, look, okay. I've never really enjoyed the Russell Westbrook experience that much, but I don't enjoy this version this season. I mean, Washington at 4-12, I believe worst record in the league right now. And, you know, he's not guarding anybody. The shot selection that I mentioned, when he's got it rolling, he can be a fun and entertaining player. It feels like he has a beef with everybody in the league right now, from Rajon Rondo to Kevin Durant. But, you know, knowing that there's multiple years of this at supermax money kind of clogging up your franchise's future, that's a tough pill to swallow, don't you think?
Oh, I mean, no question about it. There's a reason that he's been shopped around multiple times since that deal was signed. I mean, I think when the deal happened that I was more pro from the Rocket side of things. Like, I think that getting the lottery protected first in 2023 was a boon. I think that Wall is, you know, he's 2 years younger, which matters. And even though his numbers this season haven't been as good as Westbrook's, like his per game numbers, like Westbrook's win shares are in the negative right now, which is, it's like really hard to do when
not
you're averaging
though.
A triple-double.
not like surprising. I'll just say on this one, that matches the eye test, Michael. Let's just use that cool terminology. Definitely matches my eye test. Houston, you were right. I think that they're coming out as the winner here, especially at this point, pretty clearly. That one could age like fine wine for them. The only concern is Wall's health, and so far he's kind of put those questions to bed. You know, I think with Westbrook, let me ask you this, a pop quiz. Would you rather trade Bradley Beal for 75% of the James Harden trade package that Brooklyn gave up? Mm-hmm. Or would you rather trade Bradley Beal along with Russell Westbrook to get expiring contracts only back and no draft assets? In other words, would you rather use Beal to just unload the Westbrook contract and start from scratch? Or would you want to play this game of assets, you know, own some team's future, have like, you know, three or four first round picks in the future and just, you know, try to work around the awkwardness of the Westbrook experience? What do you think?
So you're basically asking me, do I want to rebuild through the time-honored tradition of New York Knicks free agency futility, or do I want to build through the draft? I'm going to build through the draft is what I'm going to do. I'm going to be really bad, and I'm going to enjoy those picks.
Yeah, I guess I'm just saying, would you use Bradley Beal's trade value as an amnesty clause to get out of the next 2 years of Westbrook?
No, that's – oh, man. That's really bad. And I also I literally don't even think that that is a possible transaction in the CBA rulebook, but just absolutely cripple whoever took that back.
Well, I was actually thinking the Knicks were going to be my leading candidate for that trade, because then they could put together an incredible starting lineup with Westbrook, Beal, RJ Barrett, Julius Randle, and Mitchell Robinson, and Knicks fans would be printing up the championship t-shirts. It could be a great turn of events, Michael. While we're here with the Wizards, Davis Bertans, regrettable contract. Can we agree? I mean, it was regrettable at the time, you know, kind of regrettable when he just didn't show up to the bubble because he was holding out for the money and you knew he probably had that organization over a barrel. Still don't understand how he wiggled 5 years out of it. You know, you're giving him 5 and 80 because you're trying to win games. You're not currently winning games. He's shooting 33% on threes after, you know, hitting 40 plus the last 2 years. He doesn't do anything else on the court. I mean, he's just a one trick pony. That's all he is, a 3-point shooter. He's not hitting his threes. Can we throw that one in there too?
This is not what you want if you're Washington, for sure. Yeah, I think it's down to 32.7% now, which is, good Lord.
Well, it's better than Porzingis, so you got that going for you. Do you have any other final regrets, Michael? I've got one more question I want to read if you don't.
Real quick, the Atlanta Hawks and John Collins. If I was Atlanta, I would have just paid John Collins. I wouldn't have dragged this out.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, I think he's proven that he's worthy of whatever amount that he wanted. I think that Atlanta, you know, based on how Gallo has looked, they're going to need to pay John Collins. And so if it's going to be the max, regardless, you might as well have it be a smoother, cleaner transaction than, you know, having your hand forced. It would be better for the relationship long term if you just paid the guy before.
I think that's completely fair. I understand where you're coming from on that. I think that it was tricky because you didn't exactly know what you were going to get from him and how it was going to fit. But ultimately, mm-hmm. like his talent level and the upside that he had shown and just the reliability of the production when he was on the court probably justified it. And I still think it was weird to throw all the money at Gallo given that position. And, you know, that could have contributed to their decision and when they wanted to spend and when they didn't as well. And it hasn't panned out to the best case scenario, but I don't think it's been the worst case scenario either. I almost think that the Gallo and Bogdanovich experience is still kind of TBD from Atlanta's side. I don't know if it's like hindered their ability to win games here, you know, with the injury for Bogdanovich necessarily, but we also haven't gotten to see, you know, them to sustain that early season momentum that we saw long enough. I just don't really know what to make of the Hawks, and I do feel like almost everything ultimately comes back to like how well is Trae Young shooting and how well is he playing and keeping his teammates involved versus just kind of going solo. So I guess the jury's still out on that, but I'm with you. Collins has played well, and he's probably just a guy that you would rather not find yourself behind the eight ball with, you know, come summertime. All right, we got one final question here to close this part up from Coach D. He says, how many Timberwolves games do you have to watch before it is classified as mentally unstable? I've watched almost every game, and I'm losing my mind. Maybe it's because Towns and D'Angelo Russell have never played three games in a row together. Maybe it's because Gerson Rosas, the basketball genius from Houston, drafted Jarrett Culver over all kinds of good players like Tyler Hero. Maybe it's because we don't have a power forward not named Jarrett Vanderbilt, who doesn't look like the formerly athletic uncle who plays at open gym for a few too many years, a.k.a. Wancho and Jake Layman. Maybe it's because I just watched Wiseman look like a superstar. He rim runs and plays defense like Capella. He moves like Towns in the open court and can somehow shoot threes better than Anthony Edwards, and he looks like Bam Adebayo on pick and rolls. Maybe it's because if we end up with the worst record in the league, there's only a 40% chance that we keep our pick. Oh, my Lord. Guys, please just give me something. Give me some generic praise for Malik Beasley. Rip into the front office for being fake. Talk about Anthony Edwards at all. No one, and I listen to a lot of NBA podcasts, talks about the Timberwolves. It feels like I'm suffering along with maybe like 200 fans that still watch games to the end, and no one else has noticed or cared. Wow. I mean, he just ripped into the entire organization as a crew, Michael. Felt a little bit like a hit 'em up there from Coach D. Coach D, I'm not sure I'm going to be able to completely sell you hope here in this situation. It's a pretty dark situation, but I do want you just to know, most importantly, you are seen, you are heard. I respect your feelings. I understand them. I'm here for you, and I'm glad that you vented, and I'm glad you communicated those things. It's very important to get that off your chest, and I do hope you feel better, and I hope that was a therapeutic experience for you. Michael, what would you like to say to Coach D?
I'm honestly surprised that Andrew Wiggins' name wasn't in this email at all.
Oh, no, no, no. Wait, so is that one of the biggest regrets, that D-Lo for Wiggins trade? I mean, look, the thing was, Wiggins was not going to work in Minnesota. That's guaranteed. But sure. I thought they paid too much for Russell, and I just have not believed in Russell. And he has lived down to all of my worst fears for him. Michael, isn't he a kind of a big piece in this overall mix?
I mean, sure. I wouldn't be really excited if I was paying D'Angelo Russell the max, when I think Malik Beasley is better than he is, just like straight up. I think he's better. So that's a problem. But I want to be a little positive here and optimistic, and I'll just say, like, Anthony Edwards is, he's looking like he's starting to put it together and look like a number one overall pick, which is really good to see. You see the aggression, the form on his spot up three looks really nice. He's starting to hit those, the physical ability just to do what he wants. He's taking on elite shot blockers and still finishing at the rim after not buying a layup and looking like Jeff Green 2.0 earlier in the season. So, like, with Edwards, like, sure, the shot selection isn't very nice. The shooting percentages on a regular basis aren't going to be what you want necessarily. But he's a rookie, so what I look for when I'm kind of assessing goes beyond numbers and just, you know, his feel for the game, his ability to just do what he wants on the floor, get to his spots. And he looks steadily improving, which is that's good to see, I guess, if you are the Minnesota Timberwolves just like scraping the bottom of the barrel trying to find some good news.
Well, I would say this. I mean, this is not really going to sound like praise or positivity, but Coach D, I don't know how you guys won five games, so you should be very glad that you've got the five wins. You look at
Come on.
No, I mean, I'm not trying to be a jerk, but it could be worse, is my point. Like, Karl Anthony Towns has barely played this season. He's their entire team. The whole thing is structured around him. As Coach D pointed out, the entire formula was pair Russell with Towns and see what it looks like. And that's going to lead to some pretty good offense. I mean, there's almost no way around that. Right now, Minnesota's 29th in offense because they haven't had their best players playing together. So that's going to be guaranteed to be a frustrating experience. I honestly think it could have been worse. I mean, it's a weird way to kind of put it. I actually think it could be worse in Washington too. You know, despite everything that we've said about, you know, all of their regrets, like the fact that they've got four wins, including one against Brooklyn, like it definitely could have been worse in that situation. So I guess that's number one. Number two, Towns will be back, right? That's going to infuse some hope. There's no way around it. And he's going to make his teammates look better because he's going to draw a lot of attention. Edwards is going to have more room to work. Russell's going to have somebody he can kind of do his pick and roll stuff with, which he just doesn't really have right now. The other wings who have been kind of filling in the gaps like a Beasley, their life is going to be easier because Towns is getting a lot of attention. There's going to be just trickle-down benefits for all those players. And I think it's very common if a superstar goes out, role players get asked to do more and they're just not capable of doing it. So everybody wants to sell stock on all the role players. And I think that's probably a little bit overreacting. For sure, look, I'm kind of with Coach D on this one, Michael. If you could do it over, would you just take Wiseman? Based on what you've seen so far, I mean, that is a fair regret to me. Like, and it was a conversation at the time. It really never seemed like they considered him too much. I'm with you.
Well,
that
I think it was the other way around.
That he never considered them?
Yeah.
Well, sometimes you got to have some backbone, Michael. You know, you just got to say, you're coming to Minnesota, whether you want to or not, right? Or you got to work a trade to make sure you're maximizing the value, whatever it might be. I would have considered that one for sure. Because Wiseman has been really impressive, but he's had his fair share of struggles too. I think the jury is still out on all of these rookies, and so I would be watching the Anthony Edwards experience a lot like you just described, Michael, which is focus on the positives, you know, get excited about the developments. Don't worry so much if there's rough nights or tough matchups where he's not really you know, scoring as effectively, or he's getting burned on defense or getting lost in certain situations. Like, don't, you know, wring your hands over that, because ultimately the stakes for this season are pretty low because you've just been dealt such a tough hand. So I guess that would be my mentality and my my approach for you, Coach D. It could be worse right now. It's almost definitely going to be better. And ultimately, it doesn't really matter because there's not a lot of stakes this season. Hopefully, that provides some level of comfort during these dark and troubling times. All right, Michael, we have a whole bunch of emails from the Open Floor Globe that we did not get to on today's episode, but I'm going to roll those over to our next episode. Michael, we heard from people all around the world who were watching basketball games at inappropriate times. You'll remember one of our listeners admitted that his marriage was ruined in Australia because of watching basketball games. We had a bunch of people weigh in with somewhat similar stories. If you've got one, email us, openfloormail@gmail.com, openfloormail@gmail.com. If you've got an NBA regret that Michael and I did not touch on today, I don't know how you could. Felt like we went on forever, Michael. Such a juicy topic with all sorts of second guessing to be done right now. Please let us know that as well. We would love to get those in the email inbox. All right, guys, you can find us on Apple Podcasts by searching for Open Floor. That's two words. When you find our page, scroll down. It will say rate and review. Tap 5 stars. It's just that easy to help us spread the word. Now, Michael is on Instagram and Twitter at Michael V as in Victor Pina. I'm on Instagram at Ben.Golliver, on Twitter at Ben Golliver. Hey, Michael, until later this week, I will talk to you.
Talk soon, Ben.